And my thanks to Peter Stanfield, who is my guest this week. Peter is a professor of film studies at the University of Kent. We find out why coming here amounted to a form of renewal after his previous job. Now, we talk about Singing Cowboys and the Coen brothers, the relationship between teaching and research. Now, Peter works in American popular cinema, really from the 1930s through to the 70s. We talk about genre, we talk about Hot Rod and the moral panic, why the 1950s resonated in the way it did in later films, including the rise of Teddy Boys in the early 70s. We talk about how he understands memories in the light of dealing with an aged mother. We talk about whether he remembers the photo or the moment that the photo was taken. Growing up in Hemel Hempstead, pop musical influences, the secret language of NME, why 1972 was such a seminal year and how he saw loads of artists like Eric Clapton on stage. We learned that Peter left school at 16, did an engineering apprenticeship. He saw the emerging punk scene in 1976 and has a list of all the gigs that he went to. He talks about going to see the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and the unmediated nature of the music in this period. We find out how Peter's love of cinema emerged. He studied at Middlesex University, then did a film MA at East Anglia in the 1980s. He remembers watching Polanski's Cul-de-sac, and he went to the cinema once and sat next to Nick Cave and The Birthday Party. We talk about there being no separation between being a consumer or fan and a researcher stroke teacher. We talk about Friends Reunited, how Peter's recall at being at school isn't that great, how he has managed to wipe out his bad teenage memories, how he doesn't have a longing to return. We talk about the relationship between nostalgia and repetition, whether Peter has fulfilled the dreams from when he was young, and the pleasure of working in academia. And at the end of the interview, we learn why Peter has never had the ambition to be a filmmaker. So many thanks to Peter Stanfield from the University of Kent for being my latest guest. My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Okay, well, my guest this afternoon is Peter Stanfield, and I think I met you about a decade ago. I don't know if that was when you came to Kent.
15 years ago.
Oh, same as me then.
Yeah, 15 years ago, 2004.
Yeah, and you very kindly some years ago lent me, or gave me some books, I think, which were in my area of theology and film, religion and film. So obviously there's an intersection along the way, which is great. Yeah. And tell me a bit then, Peter, about what you were doing, well, before you came here, and, you know, it depends how far back you want to go, but what were you doing immediately before coming to Kent?
There's a lot of years in all of this. Immediately before coming to Kent, I was teaching at Southampton Institute, which is now Southampton Solent, and I'd been there about 9 years, I think. Stuck there for a good four or five of those years. I helped set up the media and film courses and helped them kind of move towards a university status. But so it was a very interesting time early on, but it got very unbelievable amounts of work. Yeah. It was just a real slog, 19 hours front of class teaching a week. You know, so coming here was a release, a revelation, and a total renewal for me.
Yeah, I find that with a lot of the students that I teach who at the age of 21 they really want to be teachers. I don't know whether by 31 or 41 they have that same drive, but it's interesting, isn't it, because they sometimes start because they have a passion for the subject, they've just done a degree, they've written these great essays, and then they're in the classroom, and of course they're just dealing with discipline issues and how much of the teaching job is content and how much actually is the passion. Obviously it's different at university, which is why you've obviously found that sense of renewal.
I think it's to do with you have license here to do research-led teaching. Mm-hmm. So I would be teaching big generic kind of courses in media and film, and that's fine for a while, but you stop renewing yourself, and you only renew yourself if you do research and start to ask different types of questions about different types of areas. And coming to Kent meant that suddenly I could put that into practice, and I've had a very close tie in between what I research and what I teach in the, over the last 15 years, and that's been as much as anything is what has defined my time here.
And one of the great things I found as well about this profession is that you're able to cultivate your own courses. You know, nobody's ever said to me, oh, you can't teach on that. You know, the spec might have to be, you have to go through all the process of having specs approved, but no one ever challenges the content. And I've met people in film studies, actually, in other countries, one chap in Australia who does some work in the area that I work on, and he said that he's not allowed to... Well, you know, what he researches is his own business, but he can't teach his research. He's given block courses and told, this is what you have to go and do. So it's almost as though the research that we know him for, and the sort of why his name appears on my courses and all the rest of it, is actually peripheral and not recognised by his employers.
Yeah. Well, I've rarely taught the kind of the nuts and bolts of what I research, but what... The way that I approach the research and the kind of understanding that I get from having gone through that process finds their way into the classroom, or from the kind of questions I'm working with on the students comes back into the research. So it's never a kind of I've never taught a course on singing cowboys, but I've got a whole book on singing cowboys. There wouldn't be an. I recognise there's no audience for that in, you know, 18, 19 year olds now, or even 15, 20 years ago. There wouldn't have been an audience for it. But the kind of questions I asked about film going, audiences, class, race, all those kind of issues around film exhibition, film consumption, of stayed with me throughout all of my teaching. On other occasions, I've taught exactly what I've researched, but it's a kind of it's not a set model. Thinking research for teaching is not a set model, I don't think.
Yeah. And it's funny what you're saying about cowboys, because I was working on a project on Christmas and looking at Christmas films a few years ago, and someone said, why don't you do the cowboy Santa? And they said, and of course, you know who'd have to play the cowboy Santa if this was a film? Billy Bob Thornton. And suddenly all these ideas suddenly came, and you know, one day, if I get out of my present mindset, you know, if I ever... got into filmmaking, you know, Billy Bob Thornton might not be available, but that's the funny thing, though, isn't it? What you just said rings true. You've got this research sort of passion, and whether it actually develops now, maybe it never will, but it's always there. And without, you know, implicitly, you are cultivating that. The way that you teach, the examples you give, I find it with my students. Yeah. I give examples from stuff from like 25 years ago that I watched when I was at university. Yeah. They've never heard of, but it's distinctly you. And if somebody else was teaching your course, they would approach it in a very different way.
Yes, yes, it is very individual. Uniquely you.
And what? So your research then is in this area of cowboys. So, but in terms of your teaching as well, how would you sort of characterise what you're doing? You know, I personally hate it when someone says, you know, what are you studying at the moment, and what's your sort of main research area? But how would you sort of, what sort of area of film studies would best sort of be encapsulated by you?
So it's American popular cinema, more or less from the early 30s, so we're coming of synchronized sound through to the 1970s, probably to the end of the decade. Increasingly it's been about thinking about how genre works, how we should understand genre, and from that a shift away into concepts around sets of films that we understand in terms of cycles, trends and fads. And so what I've tried to do is to come up with new ways of thinking about and talking about how popular films are both conceived, produced, distributed, marketed, and exhibited, and then consumed, and how we might think about the kind of formulas that are involved in it that doesn't depend upon an ahistorical theory of genre that derives from work that was done in film studies in the 1960s, early 1970s. So I'm looking to put film back into the kind of context in which they were first produced, and how they were first seen and received.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of theoretical drive. It sits within, I think, the cultural history of American cinema. So I'm very interested in cultural histories. So a good example would be of all of this is I looked at a series of films, a cycle of films on Hot Rod Movies made in 1957. And I was interested in, the cultural history of Hot Rods and how it became a folk devil, if you like. The Hot Rodder became a folk devil, a moral panic, grew up around these juvenile delinquents. But what became clear as I researched more was that the moral panic was around about 1948-52, and the films didn't start until 57-58, the cycle, the main cycle. So why was there a gap? Why, if Hollywood's about exploiting that, which is in the news, the headlines, why didn't exploit the films in 52? And it did make a couple of films around about that time, but it wasn't until 57 that there was a noticeable cycle. You could see the cycle in 57. You could have ignored it. It's only, from digging around to find these films that had Hot Rods in them in the early part of the decade. So the question became then why, and as I began to think about the context in which these films played, that's where I found my answer, because exactly at the point in time the cycle grew in size, the number of drive-in movies was maximised as well. So you saw the height of drive-in movie, new build drive-in movies in the States in 1957, which corresponded exactly with the cycle. The cycle kind of dies away as the drive to build more and more drive-in movies dissipates. So.
Wow, so it really was sort of almost like consumer demand. It's like the infrastructure was in place at just that moment.
Yeah.
And this was the feeder.
Yeah, and also, Hollywood was the major studios were putting money into fewer and fewer films, and there was greater and greater demand for films, for new product, but Hollywood was no longer making those low budget programmers, so independents were making it, and they had they often came from exhibition backgrounds, and they had a very keen awareness of what was going to be sought by the market, and of course, so what the market gives them is. Or the audience is images of themselves. Yeah. So more and more young people, baby boomers, are going to the cinema.
Yeah.
They want to see images of themselves. So you give them images of young people sitting in cars, in diners, in driving diners or driving movies. Yeah. So it's about mobile youth for mobile youth.
Isn't it interesting how then in the 70s a lot of that stuff became almost like a nostalgia for the 50s with all the American Graffiti and then later Grease type movies where the drive-in became the centre of attention.
That's the next project really is to the project I'm thinking about is about the 1950s into the 1970s on a quite wide canvas, looking at the rock and roll revival that starts around about 68 and goes well into the 70s in all its different incarnations, with from Roxy Music to Gary Glitter, and Teddy Boy Revival and stuff like that. Yeah. So and then what's going on at the pictures with the films that you've just mentioned and musicals, graphic arts and fashion.
Yeah, because whenever I listen to Sounds of the 70s on Radio 2 on a Sunday, there's a clip at the beginning in the jingle that Johnny Walker plays where it's of Happy Days, and I always think, but that's funny because it was made in the 70s, but I always associate it with the 50s, but of course it's the 50s as seen through the lens of the 1970s.
Yeah.
But I saw it not much later, probably in the 80s. Mm. So again, it's sort of something I associate with the 80s, made in the 70s, but encapsulating the 50s. But it was, with so many different layers at work and the different generations, their own nostalgia. Grease is a classic example. The idea that you're going to watch this film and sort of see it as a recreation of an era, of course it's filtered through decades of subsequent reinterpretation.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating, but it's unpicking all those layers. It sounds like you're doing the dream project.
Unpicking layers. I'm very interested in about how why the 1950s continued to resonate in the way it did, and you can see it in the in the kind of iconography of James Dean, Marlon Brando, Marilyn Monroe. My feeling is it's kind of like the it's the origin text for the origin story for the teenager, for the juvenile delinquent, for that idea of there being a separation in the generations, and that each iteration can come back and pick on something that it finds there for itself. So one of the things I've become really interested in is was the rise in teddy boys in the early 1970s, but then once you get Mud and Sha-na-na and Gary Glitter kind of appropriating those kind of styles, it loses its kind of radical subcultural impact. And it's very noticeable that the teddy boy doesn't sort of die, but he reorientates himself towards rockabilly, because rockabilly becomes the thing which is, you know, that you have to go off and discover for yourself. You can't just go and buy it, you know, in a mainstream, you know, from Smith's or Radio Rentals or wherever you bought your records from in those days. You know, it's a specialist, and you have to have deep knowledge of the music and the culture in order to understand it. So there's a very... The 50s that you choose is always kind of politicized in subcultural terms.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested in how those kind of shifts and movements work. And so I'm busy trying to map and track all of that through the kind of ephemera as much as any kind of commentary from the time.
Yeah, because I remember an interview that Paul Simon gave when he said that even today, and he's late 70s now, he said that when he is driving through America, he always finds a radio station that's playing 1957.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting. So, and, you know, of course, that links in with the nostalgia work that I'm doing, because I worked out he would have been something like 16 at the time.
Yeah.
And so there's obviously something now that it's going back to a time and place. It's obviously, and evoking that, but having that, and the fact that it's live radio, that he's looking for something that is of the here and now, but encapsulating an era that is, you know, 60 years old.
Yeah.
But it's almost as though he needs that ballast. I mean, I do it. I mean, obviously, in my case, it's a different age. But, you know, I was listening to Pick of the Pops on the weekend, and they were covering 1981. And I was only 7 or 8. And I remember everything. I remembered all the positions, everything from, you know, the sublime to the ridiculous. You know, you might have had, you know, the stupid, like, Stars on 45 stuff. But you had Smokey Robinson. But Teardrop Explodes.
Yeah.
And you had the Undertones, Toya. But then Shakin' Stevens, you know, so a complete mismatch. But that summed up, and there was all that going on. Adam Ant was number one, and you know what a complete evocation of a time and place. But I feel I own that, you know, because it's, you know, it's also quality proof. It doesn't matter whether the music was good or not. It was, you know, it is such an integral part of who I am, and that 7-year old self is almost a sort of you know, it's almost as though there was a certain situation, a certain time and place, a certain growing up, and that became part of my DNA and has never left. So I'm wondering if it's exactly what Paul Simon is talking about when he refers to the magic of 1957.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think they're always formative years, aren't they? Those late teen years. Early 1920s. So there's that sense of, you know, the question about who am I will constantly return to those moments where you saw yourself taking the shape that you now recognise, but there were all sorts of possibilities back then. You know, you could have gone in all sorts of different directions and taken different roads. And quite why you took the ones you did isn't always opaque. I think it's ever clear.
Yeah, but it's interesting. It's almost as though there's that cultural yardstick. It's almost as though whether it, and we'll come to the charts later, but that almost that sense of there being a particular the endorsement maybe of, you know, a song doing well in the charts at a time in your life when you're starting to learn things, you're all these new adventures before you, and that's the yardstick around which everything else is measured. You mentioned Roxy Music. Immediately, I think of Changing School in 1982, and More Than This was in the charts. You know, that's my association.
Yeah, I think of Bill Murray singing it in Lost in Translation.
Oh, yeah, he does, doesn't he? And not necessarily well. Yeah. But going back a bit, what about in terms of things like, you know, earliest memory? I don't know how far you're able to go back. What sort of you remember from childhood?
Well, that's kind of interesting because I've got an aged mother now. She's 88 and she's in kind of late stages of dementia. And so I've been, well, the whole family has been thinking a lot about what memories are because her memories have become completely scrambled. And so there's a strange thing goes on with time and space with her. So she can be a child in Enderby in Leicestershire and be an adult in Hemel Hempstead at exactly the same time, place. Yeah. You know, there is no separation between being in Enderby, a seven-year-old, and being in Hemel Hempstead as a whatever she's imagined she is. And the memories that she has that she brings back are memories that she's talked about a lot through her life. They are the seminal foundation moments, I'm guessing, in her life. Mm. Things to do with separation anxiety from her mother, and her father died young. So we've been talking a lot about within the family about memory and childhood. So I remember that which is spoken about a lot. Yeah. I'm not really sure what I remember that belongs only to me. I don't know if I remember the photograph or the incident when the photograph was taken. I can have those kind of Prussian Madeleine moments where I'm suddenly taken back and, you know, I'll be in a school field. But again, it's not a specific event, or, you know, it's just a general kind of feeling of what it was to be there at that time.
Mm. And is that where you grew up?
Hemel Hempstead, yeah. New town, which I wouldn't go back to today, but looking back, was an amazing place to be. Mm. It was a new start for the country, I think, and brought people of all different kind of classes and backgrounds together. It wasn't a diverse place. I don't, you know, it was unbelievably white English.
Yeah.
But as I say, there were people from all sorts of classes, and people came to kind of build something that was different and positive and progressive, the like of which I've never encountered since. I haven't seen, I haven't felt that within England, that sense of renewal and purpose and ambition, aspirations to create a better world. Mm. So, I grew up in my father was a came over from Poland during the war. He was with his mother and sister. His father was already over here in the Polish army. He'd got out. He was a captain in the cavalry, painter, not a very good cavalryman. He was too old, and when he got here, he discovered that there wasn't much use for cavalrymen. But eventually, the family got out in 1944. Came to London. Dad went to sent to school and things like that, and supported by the kind of refugee funds and things. Anglicised, which is why my name's not a Polish name, and he chose Stanfield. No one knows why he chose Stanfield. I think it was a good choice.
Yeah,
it's not too common. And it sounds, if that sounds very English, he's since gone back and become a kind of Pole again. But the fact that my family, my brothers and my two brothers and sister are very proud of our identity as Stanfields, and so being. It's a bit like being an American. You kind of reinvent, you know, Hemel Hempstead allow you to reinvent yourself.
It sounds like a perfect synchronicity then, in terms of you're in a town where this was happening, and maybe it was because of that, or it was coincidental, you all were going through the same change in your own family, and it all came together, and you sort of had this new start.
Yeah, I think they really, I think they truly believed in it. They're both teachers, my mum and dad, and they both believed in new starts, and we had council. You know, we lived in council houses or new town commission houses. Same thing.
Yeah.
And I, when I, you know, the idea that you would become a home owner just seemed to me absurd. Yeah. Why would you ever own a home? You just put your name on a list and you wait until a house became available. And if you had kids, then you got a bigger house, you know. Yeah. And that idea that the state was a kind of beneficent provider, I think, was something I had in my background. I didn't see it as something that one raged against, as I tend to do today.
Yeah, and I was talking to a former colleague, now retired, just this morning, about how it wasn't that many years ago, 20 years ago, you know, people didn't own their own TVs. You rented them from the co-op.
Yeah.
And that was my experience as well. It's absurd now. If my TV broke now, I would just buy a new one from the supermarket, and I knew it wouldn't be that expensive either.
Yeah.
But that sense of, you know, something that's going to last a decade and it's going to be, you know, the centre of the living room, you know, everything's splintered these days. But you're right, there is that sense in which it was almost as though it was just, you know, we shared and we borrowed, and if something went wrong, an engineer would come out and fix it. You know, it's just, it's a different world. It's almost laughable now.
That it is really, there weren't the number of material possessions. And we rented our TV from Radio Rentals.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I have vague memories of getting a colour TV very late in the day, and few friends would have colour TVs, but not many. It wasn't a given that you'd be left out or anything. But you weren't at the forefront of the kind of new technologies, you know. But
But what are some of the things that you enjoyed doing as a child?
One of the great things about Hemel Hempstead was that it's an incredibly green town. It was at least when as it was originally conceived, each community, each area where Warner Brothers, Chorlton, Gaybridge, all had their own church, had their own community centre, had their own shopping precinct, had their own primary school, infants, junior, secondary school, which quickly became comprehensives. But there was a couple of grammars. But as a child, my memory is of playing in the fields and in the woods. Wherever we lived, there seemed to be a spinny down at the end of it, which was kind of always a slightly magical kind of place. So I think I had that sense of countryside was always just on the edge of things, and you know, it was easily accessible. And we roamed freely. There wasn't the kind of cars and the traffic. I mean, I talked to my mum about this when I was taking my daughters to school and saying, you know, it's like, you didn't walk us to school. You know, from a very early age, 6 years old or something, we took ourselves off to school on our own.
Yeah, my experience as well.
You know, and she said, well, you didn't have to worry about the traffic.
Yeah,
we could walk across fields and, you know, down lanes and get to school without crossing any main roads. That's an abiding kind of memory, is the lack of traffic, the greenness of the world, and the kind of, you know, same as every other kid, long hot summers, you know, those kind of things. But we didn't go on foreign holidays or anything like that. We'd go camping somewhere in Wales, but so it's very much about around the house or around the town. As a youngster.
Yeah. No, my parents have never had a passport, but what you said about school is really interesting. That idea that, you know, these days with my own children, it's unthinkable that they would walk to school on their own, and yet I walked to the bus stop, which when I went back to my home in Cardiff, the suburb of Cardiff where I lived about a year ago, what seemed a really long walk when you're like 6 years old, it's just like the other side of the street. So it's not that big. But nevertheless, there was a sense that, you know, you say goodbye to your parents and you run off to get the school bus.
Yeah.
Unthinkable that you do that these days.
Yeah.
But so, and it's the traffic, but I guess it's also a safety thing. But people just didn't think in those days about the risks of, you know, children being, I don't know, abducted or whatever. I don't know. Whatever, something has changed in the decades.
Well, changed, yeah, but they must. Well, I don't know. I mean, I was a child, but the Moors murderers must have left a mark on people and worrying about children.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a sense that the people in the street would keep an eye out for other people in the street. And there were a lot of people around during the day. So mothers were at home, you know, because it was a new town, it was about new families, it was a big part of the baby boom. You know, there were a lot of mothers and a lot of young children, and that so that it did feel different than it is today in all kinds of ways.
That's true. You'd have the curtains twitching, and you were always aware that you'd be playing out with your friends, and suddenly somebody would come out of the house and say, "My husband works shifts. You know, can you play somewhere else?"
Yes, I heard that time and time again. Yeah, the shift. That's right. I'd completely forgotten about that. Yeah. The shift worker. Yeah, that was a big part of it. Yeah,
I mean, my dad was on the railways for many years. He would often, you know, there were periods when I wouldn't even see him because he'd get home. You know, when we were in bed, or he'd be working certainly, you know, during the nights.
Yeah, that's right.
Different world. Yeah. What about things like music? Because we've touched on that a little bit, but for me, the charts were everything. You know, growing up, writing them down even on a Sunday. But you know, was there a sense in which this was something that? Well, I think I'm guessing the answer is probably not necessarily the charts, but but that sense of what was the sort of music that you were exposed to? Was it stuff that your peers were listening to? Was it stuff that your parents were listening to? Is it stuff that you found on your own, sort of for your independent or with your siblings, your sort of independent record collection? What was going on?
Well, my parents didn't listen to pop music, or they might have Simon and Garfunkel in the house, or a couple of Beatles discs. Mum always hated pop music, liked classical was her thing. Dad was never that interested, I don't think. Pop music became increasingly important as I went through my adolescence. I think football was the first thing, and football was the means by which you cemented relationships with your peer group. And Hemel Hempstead was quite different because it had all these people that come from North London and East London, lots of North Londoners more than East Londoners. And I know that because most of my friends at school were Arsenal or Tottenham fans, and there would be one or two West Ham fans, and there would be QPR fans, and I was a Chelsea fan because my best friend was a Chelsea fan. My dad wasn't interested in football, so I was the first and since the family has become kind of identified with Chelsea, and I went to see my first match, which my dad took me to in 1969, Chelsea Man United at Stamford Bridge, and Chelsea won 3-2. It was over 70,000 people in the crowd. It was quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, how they got them in, the health and safety
factor,
you know, it's just incredible. So football was very important. Everybody played, everybody went to see, and also we were quite close to Watford, which would probably be in the third division back then, but you could go for virtually nothing to go and see them. So I had friends too who followed Watford, and I would often go with them. Grew into my teens, and as I began to kind of define myself, the music became the more important factor in my life. And I can remember getting my first copy of New Musical Express, and it seemed to me that it spoke a secret language, and a secret language that I wanted to learn. I wanted to be able to complete the crossword at the back.
Okay.
Which, if I looked at it today, would be ridiculously simple. But when you're 14, it's filled with references to pop stars that probably only were, you know, 6 months before I started to pay real attention to popular music. But I couldn't, they were already history, and it seemed to be constantly changing. And so keeping up with what was going on was just. And there was an extraordinary thrill about it. There was a thrill about buying a new record or seeing them on Top of the Pops and going. A lot of people talk about that moment where they saw Bowie doing Starman. And I can't remember. I must have seen it. We always watched Top of the Pops. I don't remember having that kind of that frisson, that moment. But I do remember Roxy Music and Virginia playing Alice Cooper, School's Out, Slade, Come On, Feel the Noise.
Sounds like 72 sort of period.
Yeah, 72, so I'm 14, and it's absolutely crucial kind of year. Really, really powerful. Lou Reed then was one. Everybody, because you couldn't buy every record, and so you'd have a pal who bought all of the new, you know, David Bowie, and someone got the Slade, someone else got the Faces and Rod Stewart, and someone else, you know, so, and I got, mine was Lou Reed and Mott the Hoople. And so being an aficionado, being a connoisseur, became increasingly important. So the charts, as one got to sort of 16, 17, mm-hmm. became less and less important. One, you know, then you were kind of listening to Led Zeppelin or the kind of more kind of progressive end. I mean, you know, kind of copies of Jethro Tull's Aqualung being passed about on some people had, you know, ELP albums and stuff like that. And then, of course, we started to go to see bands, and we see bands at the Hemel Hempstead Pavilion. Just about everybody came. I was talking to my brother the other day. He said, "I can't believe we missed Bowie when he played there on the Ziggy Stardust tour." But it was at the beginning of the tour. But again, it was that sense that, you know, things were happening so fast. Unless you were paying real attention, you didn't see it. But most of we saw things like Leonard Skinner came and played before they played at Nebworth. Mm. Eric Clapton. Lots of big bands played there, and if you kind of camped out all night, you could get tickets. But lots of the kind of smaller up and coming bands and played there too. And then, of course, eventually, one around about age 16 started going to the Rainbow and Hammersmith Odeon, those kinds of concerts, and then things like the Rolling Stones at Wembley, no, Earl's Court, Wembley or Earl's Court, I can't remember who at Wembley, Led Zeppelin at Earl's Court. So got a real kind of a sense of adventure and of a kind of pop as an ever ongoing event, you know. So that took us. At 16, I left school and went into. I didn't have any qualifications at all, and went into an engineering apprenticeship, and that gave me some money and more freedom, and I spent all that money on gigs and records. Mm-hmm. And then I think the biggest shift in my life was 76, and going up to London to watch the emerging punk scene. So I saw the Clash in about a fourth gig at the Roundhouse at the bottom of the bill, Kersal Flyers on the top, Crazy Cavan and the Rhythm Rockers in the middle, and Clash as a five-piece with Keith Levine on guitar. And those things, along with the first Ramones album, just changed your life.
Yeah. And did you feel it at the time? Did you at the time think this? You know, nothing's ever going to be the same again.
Not that again, because things seem to be moving so very, so very, very rapidly, just keeping up, making the choices of who you were going to see was there was just so much. Yeah. It was incredible. I think that I cherished things like having seen Eddie and the Hot Rods in the Marquee in the hot summer of 76, and then it coming out on an EP that was in the charts, and Get Out of Denver, and to say I was there at this.
Were there any bands that you didn't see? But you
I didn't see.
You
the, yeah, I didn't see the Sex Pistols. I thought they were. I was always going to see them next week or something. I didn't see them, but and then of course, as soon as the had no sense that the Grundy thing was going to take off. They would just, you know, they would come and play at the Pavilion before too long or something. And there was a bit of rivalry anyway between the Sex Pistols and Eddie and the Hot Rods. And I was a really big Dr. Feelgood fan and Canvey Island. And I loved all of that kind of working class authenticity. So I missed the Pistols, but I saw everybody else. I mean, the Stranglers at the Nashville Rooms on a good number of times. The Jam at the Nashville Rooms with like eight people in. They did two sets and did things like Route 66 and Slow Down and Mustang Sally, and it's like a kind of, they're kind of jukebox band. And followed them for a long time afterwards, and the Clash on numerous occasions, twice on the White Riot tour. So, yeah.
Did you keep a diary at all?
No, I've got a my brother. I found something. Yeah, yeah. Not a proper diary, but it was a kind of list of gigs, yeah. That. And I had a friend who did all that. But there was a kind of shock, and I went. There was a new second-hand record store opened in Broadstairs, and above the racks was like book behind Perspex old sheets from NME, and one was from January 1976, and you could see who was playing at the Nashville Rooms. Oh, was that one?
Yeah. Yeah. Was something we were saying just before we started recording is that I make this, well, rather regular pilgrimage to the cinema. It's like, for me, the idea of just going home, putting on the TV, or, you know, it's so easy. There has to be a journey involved.
Yes.
And I will always associate it, you know, I really wanted to see this film. I could go to the Gulbenkian, which is, literally, you know, 10 yards from where we are sitting now. Or I could drive to Sandwich or Dover or Ashford or somewhere and feel that I'm sort of like part, you know, it's sort of like all the preparation for that. But it sounds like that's what you were doing with these gigs, because unfortunately, I never really did anything like that. In recent years, I've gone to a few gigs, but when I was younger, it was all filtered through the radio.
Yeah.
But that is intriguing in itself, because it's what the DJs at the time, I mean, I'm, you know, looking back, it's a bit sort of almost weird. I remember the whole, like, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and, you know, Mike Reed, you know, thought it was in bad taste.
That's right, yeah.
But that was the bizarre thing. But it's almost as though he was the cultural arbiter, you know, and he was a presenter. You know, I know the bit more about how the BBC works now, and he's sort of fallen out of favour a bit as well, not least because of his politics. But the idea that because Mike Reed on The Breakfast Show would sort of be dismissive of a song or something, then, although of course it didn't stop it going to number one. But isn't that really interesting? And but what I wished I'd had in that sense was to have that pure experience of seeing what it is like to see a band proper, and the radio then can be almost the encapsulation of that, rather than it being the primary go-to. Yeah. So I kind of feel everything's always been very sort of secondary, like pale imitation, sort of, you know, Plato's cave of the real thing. I very much envy what you've just been outlining.
Well, I like that. Yeah, that it's always a journey. Yeah. So from being in Hemel Hempstead is about being, you know, a commuter in the commuter belt and getting on that train going up to Euston, and then trying to figure out whether or not you're going to be able to get back in time. I remember a friend we went to see, we'd already seen him a few times before, Elvis Costello at the Nashville Rooms. Wow. It was like a New Year's Eve or Christmas Eve, I can't remember. There's a recording of it on as an additional disc on one of the reissues of My Aim Is True. And I had a remarkable, strong memory of it, unless I'd heard a recording of it since. But anyway, a friend I'd gone up with was so obsessed, was totally and utterly obsessed with Elvis Costello, and he wouldn't leave until the gig was done. Yeah. We left at before the encore. Yeah. Got the train back. I don't know how he ever got home.
But didn't care either. By the
no, side. Because it's about the journey, you know. It's about that kind of, you know, the pursuit of the of pleasure, or pursuit of an idea, or a kind of pursuit of style.
But I'm interested in that idea of, you know, can you be nostalgic for times that you didn't experience? But for me, I remember Elvis Costello. I was too young for Oliver's Army, but I do remember Goodyear for the Roses. But that's not for that to be the starting point. You know, that's not necessarily representative of him, perhaps. Or at least that's not as cutting edge as some of the earlier stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, when it came out, I remember we were watching On Top of the Pops, and we were going to recording it on an LP, put the microphone in front of the TV and record this song. And I think it was my sister that said, "Oh, it's a bit slow, this one, isn't it?" Or we want, you know, because looking back, Elvis, you know, that's the thing. But I had none of that prehistory.
Yeah.
I guess Radio 1 in those days played an awful lot of older... They did play an awful lot of older stuff. But for me, you know, it was the now, it was the charts, it was the stuff from 81 that mattered. But it's bizarre looking back to what I was just saying. Smokey Robinson, you know, I didn't think of Tears of a Clown. I think of Being With You. But that was in his next stage of his career.
Yeah.
And the same for a lot of these other artists.
Yeah.
But you went to see them. What is brilliant about what you were just outlining is that you saw these bands when they were up and coming, before they got, in many cases, really... Because if they were really super big, you may not have seen them at the venues that you saw them at.
No, and I after having seen Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and the Who, at Wembley and at Charlton Football Ground, it was such a poor experience. I can remember the Rolling Stones, we were at the back of the stage, it had a circular revolving stage, but it took forever for the band to roll around towards us and then kind of raise an arm to recognise our existence, and the sound was so appalling. It went all the way to one end of the building and came back before we heard it. So they kind of finished playing Get Off My Cloud before we could hear it. It was such bad sound.
Yeah.
And then Led Zeppelin, you know, went into Moby Dick, I think that was the one with the endless drum solo. And you could walk, I walked all the way around Earl's Court and sat back down again. They're still playing it. It was like, oh my God. So discovering the Marquee and small places like the Red Cow in Hammersmith and the National Rooms in Kensington, and the Hope and Anchor was a you know, incredibly important place. Dingwall's Dance Hall in Camden, all of these kind of places meant that you know, you had a totally different relationship within the audience and with the artists. It was much, much closer. And also because the thing was that in terms of generation, they were only probably a couple, you know, Paul Weller would be exactly the same age as me, and, you know, people in the Clash got only just a few years older. So there was that sense of that kind of narcissistic identification one has is enabled by that close proximity.
Yeah, because I went to Wembley Arena not long ago, well, last month, 2 months, to see Hall and Oates with a friend. You know, it was great, except for one thing. We were right at the back, and and I couldn't, you'd only see them on these big screens, and because then it's like, well, why did we come all this way? You can barely see it. And then I was more conscious of the audience around. I mean, that's one of the things I like doing. You know, it's great to sort of watch people watching the, you know, who am I part of this demographic? You know, I don't look like anything. I don't look anything like the people who have come to see this film. Yeah, I can't wait to see this. But they're here for different reasons, whatever. Yeah. But isn't that interesting, though? But for me, it kind of spoils it a bit, because I was looking forward to seeing them. They were never, you know, I knew, you know, I can't go for that. I know all that stuff and really like it. But somehow I felt that displacement. But from what you're saying, these venues were small, and you really remembered them and seeing them up close and personal.
Yeah. I mean, there's I've got there's if you flick through kind of picture punk books of the time, I come across pictures of myself in the audience, or there's one of me on stage banging two plastic beer glasses together to Go Buddy Go with the Stranglers. And it's I've barely changed. The hair is really fuzzy. I've got flared trousers on and I've got a Chelsea scarf wrapped around my waist, you know, and so, but I'm still all in denim, you know, not quite cut the same way anymore, didn't cost as much. But so one can find one, that's how close one could be, you know. There was I think what punk did more than anything was to break that barrier down between the audiences and the performers. And I've been doing a lot of work. My latest book is going to be on The Who and pop art, with the subtitle A Band with Built-in Hate. And reading about The Who in the early days, in 1964-65, Pete Townshend always talks about that they were given permission by the audience to play. It was the audience who were in charge, not the artists. And of course, by the time I got to see them in 74 or whenever it was, it was very much the reversal. You know, one came as a kind of, it was a pilgrimage, you know, like the scenes in Tommy, to go and see these great rock stars, you know, and to pay homage to them. And then I think what was extraordinary about punk was that it just broke those barriers down and brought everything much back down to a human level. So there was the separation between audience and audience and a performer, and the distinction between them was, you know, because I can remember going to see Eddie and Hot Rods and seeing Rat Scabies on the corner and singing, oh, he's the drummer in the Damned, and then going to see the Damned. Yeah. So you get the do you see? So
there were loads of those. I saw 10cc on stage recently, and, you know, there's so many bands, and they played it in other bands and they came back, and all part of that. Era. Like, if they may have fallen out, maybe they got back together.
So it was that kind of that there was that shuffling constantly between performer and audience. I find, looking back, really extraordinary. I wasn't quite sure. I wouldn't have put it in those terms. It was just very, very exciting, and it was very cheap and very, very accessible. That was the thing. But also, what was extraordinary about it was that it it was self-defining, that you weren't being defined by other people. You were ahead of the curve as far as, you know, even the enemy or the sounds or melody maker was concerned, because you were defining the scene. It wasn't being defined for you.
Yeah, you didn't have the same sort of filter that, in a way that with radio stations, and they have their particular, you know, demographic, and obviously the studios in terms of what they're able to produce, and it's money that talks. Yeah. In this sense, it was a pure experience.
It's kind of slightly unmediated, and I think that's quite a rare to have over a kind of concentrated period of time. I mean, maybe it was two years, 76 to 78, and then it just kind of became formalised and much more, you know, going to see the Jam was I can't remember going to see the Jam at the Rainbow, and I think I was the only person in a leather jacket there. It had become the whole mod revival thing had happened, and it no longer felt like you had possession of it, you'd lost it, but there were other things that would come up very quickly afterwards to take its place. But but for those two short years, it did feel like it was unmediated, and you did own the territory that you were travelling across. Yeah. You know, those journeys you talked about.
And did you ever imagine back then that you'd be, like you mentioned, the Who? You're writing a book on the Who.
Yeah.
Could you ever have imagined back then that you'd ever have ended up studying this? Because you mentioned you left school at 16.
Yeah.
You know, the route, I mean, maybe that's where we should turn in that sense. Yeah. How that transition was almost as though you may have left school at 16, but there was obviously something in you that said, no, this is unfinished business. And it sounds as though you've now sort of everything's come full circle.
Yeah, so you got, so the what everybody does in Hemel, if they've got any now, is they get out. And I got out when I was 20, 21, moved up to London. Just above King's Cross, Caledonian Road, pretty run down bedsit, but it was a kind of hub where people kind of gravitated. You know, so we still stayed in the same sort of gangs and groups of people. And some of my friends did go on to university and art school in London. By the time I moved to London, I'd given up I finished my apprenticeship, but I'd given up working. Gone to tour the States in 1979. The dollar was, you could get $2.60 for the pound. I mean, it was a cheap air flight as well. I was there for, I think we were there 5 or 6 weeks. Interestingly, or in terms of the earlier thing, going to Max's Kansas City and seeing Johnny Thunders was a life-enhancing moment. I'd seen him many times in Britain, but that was to see him on his own home turf was something. Anyway, I came back from the States, and it was I can remember thinking, there's more to life than the blunt end of a grinding machine in a factory, and I really wasn't prepared to go back and continue that life. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was still sort of completely obsessed with popular music, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So moving to London was the break that was necessary from that past to the new bright new future, whatever that might be. But it really wasn't. I still didn't think much beyond the week ahead, you know, and good times and fun. But I had more leisure time, and I spent more of that leisure time reading. I was never a great reader, but I always enjoyed reading. And the bedsit I lived in was opposite a very small branch of the Islington Library, and I started to read more and more American fiction, and the Kerouac, Steinbeck, Faulkner, that type of thing, along with Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. I was really in love with those two writers, and the Scala Cinema had opened up. It had shifted from Charing Cross to the big old cinema in King's Cross, the top half of it. It'd been an apiary. They had monkeys in there anyway. And when you apiary. And downstairs, I think it's still a snooker hall. But the second level had been this apiary, but then it come back into being a cinema. But when you went there, and the opening was a double bill of Polanski's cul-de-sac, new prints of cul-de-sac and Repulsion.
Wow.
When you went in there, the screen was suspended from the ceiling, and on the floor you could see the big speakers, and then you could see these old kind of plastic, what must have been glass fibre, yeah, rocks for the apes to sit in. You could still smell the ape smell. And the trains would go beneath the cinema and make it rumble, but I suddenly discovered cinema for the first time. I'd always loved movies and going to the movies, but I discovered cinema, if that distinction between movies and cinema is knowable. So so a new start, reading, going to having this like phenomenal cinema at the bottom, you know, more or less at the bottom road. One could go and see triple bills of Robert Mitchum films or Sam Fuller films for 50p. And then I discovered that Middlesex Polytechnic had a kind of access course, a diploma of higher education, and you just basically had to go and pass an interview, be interesting enough to be interviewed, and I just took the chance and got in, and I don't know how or why they chose, as I said before, that I was, you know, going to have any kind of potential. I'd never written an essay in my life, and I remember writing the first essay and I just, and of course it's all in longhand, I doubt I'd written 500 words straight out, you know, so it was unbelievable learning process, but I loved being in the classroom and listening and taking on ideas and reading more and more about what was the kind of areas that American studies was. Well, it was a kind of general introduction to humanities, and so you got a bit of social science, you got a bit of communication studies, a bit of bit of history, you know, and I struggled. Desperately struggled because I just didn't have any of the background that an A-level would have given you in any of these subject areas. I didn't know how to read in a kind of focused, concentrated way, and I certainly couldn't write. I wasn't dyslexic, or I didn't have, you know, it just, I had never practiced writing. And, I struggled, but I maintained passing grades. But I just committed myself to study and to being a student whilst enjoying being in London and all the things that were going on around us, and didn't give up on any of that. But the cinema became more and more important, and the idea of studying American cinema seemed a possibility. In the final year, I got my grades up because I went to... I did a half a year abroad in California State, Hayward, and I discovered actually I did know an awful lot compared to my American peers. I came back with first class marks from this, which kind of brought my 2-2 marks up to a 2-1, and therefore I could then, you know, credibly apply to do an MA somewhere. Very few people seem to do MAs back in the mid 1980s. And University of East Anglia had started a taught film MA. It was the first one in the country with Thomas Ilsasser, Charles Barr, Don Rambo. And so for the first time, I took myself out to Southeast and went to Norfolk, lived in Norfolk for a couple of years and did the MA part-time. And that's where really things came together. And again, I still struggled as an academic. I just didn't have the chops, and I couldn't write, still couldn't write well. But I just loved the idea of being a student, and I was dedicated to getting better. And I think I had genuine motivation to see things improve. So.
And it sounds like the two fed off each other, that you were studying, but the cinema down the road...
Yeah.
Clearly was that it was like the twin passions were sort of all together. The one you needed one for the other.
I think without cinema, I wouldn't have been an academic. Yeah. I definitely wouldn't, because partly because again it's this idea of being involved in the new, like Hemel Hempstead or punk rock or it was about, you know, the study of cinema. Although it, you know, it'd been, you know, there was perhaps 20 years at least 10 years prior to me getting involved, it being part of academia. But it wasn't fully at the centre. It was still very much at the margins of sociology courses or English literature courses or modern language courses. Only in the mid-1980s does it start to become a key part of the portfolio of humanities degrees.
And has that carried through to today? Do you still find that the cinema is something that you partake in? I don't know if that's the right term. I mean, I lost it for various personal reasons, really, and then completely besotted now with, you know, the cinema. I go all the time. It's a great structure. But when you mention, like, Polanski seeing Call to Sight Repulsion, I mean, that for me... You know, I mean, I saw Taxi Driver, Clockwork Orange when I was young, obviously not at the actual time. And to this day, those were groundbreaking experiences. Yeah.
Well, they were more groundbreaking experiences seeing films like that than seeing Taxi Driver when it came out or Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, partly because that just felt like you were in just a flow of whatever was being released. Yeah. When you went to the Scala, this was cinema as opposed to going to the movies. One was going to discover something that never seen before. There was always going to be that kind of shock of the new available to you, even if the films were extraordinarily old, or at least relative to what I was used to. So a good example of this would be a few weeks after they showed this new prints of the Polanski films, they showed Pasolini's Salo. Now, I had no idea what this film was going to be about. I just went because it was the film that they were promoting.
Yeah.
And there I was, watching this extraordinary movie, but looking around at the audience, which was filled with gay clones, you know, and they're kind of cruising with the leather gear and moustaches and everything like that. And I hadn't encountered this cult, you know, I knew... Obviously knew it exists, but our paths hadn't crossed, and then there it was, and we crossed in the cinema, and the cinema, as I said, again, it was a place where you could just see other people that, you know, you'd see, and I'd go and see The Birthday Party, a Nick Kaye play, and then I'd go and watch Robert Mitchum in Night of the Hunter with a double bill of John Huston's Wise Blood on the Flannery O'Connor story. And who's sitting next to me? But Nick Cave and the rest of the Birthday Party, you know. Yeah. So it's like that, you know, because there was no, you know, you consumed what the bands consumed, you know, because you were so tightly involved. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. See, that's interesting, because my apprehension of cinema so often today, often it's convenience and cost, is multiplexes.
Yeah.
And in that sense, there's
They're anonymous, right? But the Scala wasn't that way. It had the all-night things with John Waters and... the midnight movie. It's the British version of the midnight movie thing in the States. Yeah. And so it was, you recognised other people that would go to the cinema. Yeah.
So it's identity.
And so we'd go and see this band, and you know, made this kind of music, and then I'd go and watch this kind of film, and I'd see the same people that were at the gig, or if not for the actual musicians. And then, you know, you'd be walking down the street with a copy of a Jim Thompson Pobb novel, and you'd see the person walking down the street with a copy. It's just so small. It's such very, very small, really, set of interactions. And that continued through that, and what being a scholar did, or trying to become a scholar did, was to make meaning of that,
It sounds like you were doing in a formalised way what you already were doing anyway.
Yeah.
And so in a way, I can see how it all dovetailed. It wasn't a great leap. You already had the contours, the methodology almost in place. It was a matter of finding a particular structure that you could map it onto. But the raw material was already developed.
Already there. It was, I think what became a scholar became was that it became all consuming. It defined every aspect of my, until I became a parent, it defined every aspect of my life. There was no separation between being a consumer, a fan, and a scholar, you know, and a researcher. Yeah. teacher. You know, I would teach what I, you know, what I pretty much.
Yeah, and I find even now, maybe that's my justification to myself for doing it. But I'll go to the cinema a lot, and I watch. You know, I'll see as much of every, you know, everything that I can, but I will always put up a review. And I do that because it's also for my own sake. But otherwise, I just don't want to have this, you know. Imagine a scenario whereby you're asking, you know, somebody asked me in X number of years' time, so have you seen this? Have you seen that? And I go, oh, I think so. I can't remember. Otherwise, you know, there has to be something concretized about it. And having that review, it's of that moment. And I might have a different apprehension of that same film on a different occasion. Yeah. But I need to have something there, but then to share it. So I would always go on my own. For me, cinema is very much a solitary thing. But then the sharing comes when I then say, this is what I saw, and I saw Gloria Bell last night, which I really liked, actually. And then, you know, it's a matter of then saying to people, you know, you might like this because blah blah blah. And then as a result of that, they say, okay, well, actually, on the basis of that, I'm interested in that, you know. So there's a sense of sharing what you know, but the actual going, the same way, like, you know, people might read the books that you write, but you're not going to be writing it with them there, you know. So you might dedicate it to your family, but you're not going to be writing it with your family, sort of thing. So the separation is necessary, but there's always that need to disseminate what you're doing, and that's what we do as academics all the time. We sit in our offices, often people don't know where we are, our families don't know what the hell we're up to, and then suddenly you say, here we are, this is, and they say, ah, so at least there's a product at the end of it, so it hasn't all been in vain.
Well, that's true, you know. I always justify my excessive consumption records and books as you know, primary materials for my next project. In some ways they are, they don't, you know, is excessive, but but it does too have that side to it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
But I think there is I think in if you're prone to it, there is always that moment that's where you are completely in love with the cinema. It can't stay with you all of your life. You can't maintain that level of commitment to the media, but you may well, like you say, you come back to it. I find that I've lived too long from metropolitan centres, 30 plus years away from London now, and being in Norwich, you had Cinema City, which was great, but down in when I was first taught in Bournemouth, and had nothing worth going to see, you know. I think the only film I can remember going to see in Bournemouth was Do the Right Thing, and maybe Reservoir Dogs.
Spike Lee,
Those two films stand out, but they were in a mainstream cinema in the centre of town, and then moving further along the coast and stuff. So I kept, I lost that sense of travelling to the cinema. VHS tapes and Channel 4. Channel 4 particularly, I think, had a big impact in that it kind of killed the repertory cinemas, the specialist cinemas that I really deeply loved. It was something to really value, Channel 4, but it also killed the thing that you loved, and VHS tapes killed it too. Because now you didn't have to make that special journey to go and see that Robert Mitchum film you'd never seen before. You just, you know, you could catch it and tape it off of Channel 4, or buy a copy of it. So that changed the relationship with the moving image that I once had. It stopped becoming quite such a it was always a social event, or it's best for me. It was always a social event, but like you, it could also be a deeply individual. I'm very happy to go to the view in Westwood Cross on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, spend my £4.99 and watch the film almost completely by myself. I in fact, that's my idea. There's nobody else in the room. I'm very I thoroughly enjoy that. On the other hand, I also really like that, you know, going with partners and friends to see movies. But the sense that it's an event, that it's the chances of me seeing something I've never seen before, or a new twist on something I'm familiar with, is long gone. I've become much more blasé, and that is a shame. I haven't lost my love for the movies, but contemporary film going, I'm much more blasé.
But I'm conscious that, as well as seeing all the new stuff, I'm always posting on social media different film sort of images of films that I watched 25 years ago. And there's a lot of those, not, you know, those are like early 90s, those erotic thrillers or the sort of, you know, the films that never got good reviews, but at the time they seemed like Sliver or obviously Basic Instinct. Yeah. But also the one I posted today was Dead Ringers, you know, with Jeremy Irons, the twin gynecologist. And also that sort of, they make a real impression.
Yeah.
And somehow, I go to the cinema a lot now, but those are always, I think they are always going to be the go-to movies.
Yeah.
No matter how good a film that I see now, I think it's always going to be a shadow of the stuff that... and I don't know whether it's probably autobiographical. That's just me, because that's like we were saying about Paul Simon earlier.
Yeah.
You know, that's my era and that's my stuff, and that's not going to change. But I also do wonder whether the quality of stuff then was better. I don't know it, or maybe it's because a lot of these cliches, you know, films now are just recycling some of these same tropes, and therefore it's almost nice to go back to the basics there.
Yeah, I think often we think that we're in the middle of something that is totally unique and extraordinary, and then later on, when we become scholars and we look back and we can see actually the uniqueness is it's more novelty. It's actually filmmaking hadn't changed that much between 1967 and 1987 for example, but. So I think there's a kind of one's better able to see the longer kind of trends and how they work. Nevertheless, those formative films remain formative. You don't shift.
Like my children when they're older, they'll start at a different point, but that will be their entry point. Yeah. So they might go backwards, but they'll also very much go forwards from that point. Okay, a few more perhaps sort of philosophically based questions just before we round up. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey your whole life and career?
Again, I have thought about this before. Not just before coming here to talk to you, but I have thought about this for several years back at kind of start of the internet, and there was a thing called Friends Reunited.
It was I do remember that
before Facebook. And my wife at the time, she went on and she discovered just about everybody, and she had almost total recall of the whole of her classes. Who a teacher was, and events that happened there. I went on, I couldn't find anybody. I realised I had virtually no recall of classes at school. There was my, you know, firm group of pals, the kind of gang I ran around with. I still remember. But the wider group that we would have sat within, I had no memory of. I think I must have a kind of an ability to kind of wipe out those times, those periods, or certain aspects of those periods where life was actually really quite difficult. I was a very, very angry youth. I was not at all a happy teenager. I got in all sorts of trouble, and school I went to because that's where my friends were, but I didn't go to sit in the classroom. I finished without any qualifications, I was a very disaffected youth with a very young, my dad left home and stuff like that, you know, and it was all totally understandable looking back, and but that has meant that I think I do have a kind of a real innate ability just to kind of wipe the slate clean and just move on. I have no... The worst time I could ever go back to would be my teenage years. I would never go back.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even really want to go back to last week, because I'm quite looking forward to next week, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, actually, you've actually sort of answered the next three questions, because the next one was going to be whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And it sounds like actually better than that, you actually wipe those negative experiences out and therefore you don't have to have that sense of comparison.
No, nostalgia is about a kind of longing to return. I don't have it, which is not to say that I don't find that the past often defines me in all kinds of ways, like, you know, from music taste and things, but one of the things I did with my kind of interest in popular music was to go right back, and that's what, you know, I became early kind of recorded music, American music, and Jimmy Rogers in the beginning of country music and country yeah. blues, and a kind of love affair with that, which took me back to the movies and Gene Autry and singing yeah. cowboys, not because I had a particular nostalgia for singing cowboys, which are way before my time, but because I wanted to know why cowboys yodeled.
Yeah.
Because
you just reminded me of, is it Buster Scruggs, the latest?
Buster Scruggs, yeah. So you get that, yeah. but which is like, it's just a bizarre film because they're not old enough to have a, you know, to have a memory, you know, so there it's filtered through a film history that they don't have a kind of direct.
The Coens.
Yeah, yeah, the Coens. It doesn't, yeah, it's their nostalgia is all mediated.
Mm.
It's not a. It never feels like a directness, like Tarantino or something. It's
yeah, I find with the Coens as well that some of their stuff it feels and it's intentional. They're brilliant at what they do, but there is a sense in which sometimes it's very stylized,
yeah.
but to the point that sometimes it feels a bit like Kubrick when he was making The Shining. It yeah. lacks the edge. It almost feels very yeah. deliberate and hyper real. And actually not all that warm as films. I mean, the one film of this I think is their best is The Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah.
But that is utterly, it's built on everything from 30s to 50s, you know, yeah. the screwball comedies
yeah.
with, you know, the sort of the big sort of corporation type 1950s high-rise
yeah.
American Manhattan buildings that sort of yeah. north, you see at the beginning of North by Northwest. And it's playing on a whole range of yeah. different genres. And also you've got the Christmas motif. So you have the 30s, yeah. the 50s, and also the 40s with It's a Wonderful yeah. Life and the angel figure comes down. And it kind of works, but in a way that you know it's like a postmodern nod to the almost to the audience. Yeah. But none of it feels very mediated,
yeah.
and for that reason, I can admire them. I'm not sure I actually find the Coen brothers. I really find their films all that inviting and all that emotionally.
No, I enjoy them warm. Always. There's a few that I didn't enjoy yeah. much, but I didn't enjoy the one about the Roman Hollywood and making their kind of Roman epics.
With George Clooney, yeah, I haven't seen it. Yeah,
yeah, I didn't enjoy that one at all. But mostly, I do enjoy them. I did enjoy Buster Scruggs. I thought there were some great yeah. moments in it. But I don't care for them at all. Yeah. I can, you know, yeah. I wouldn't want to write about them. I would just yeah. leave them behind. Yeah. I want to, if I write about something, I want to be committed to it. Yeah. It doesn't have to be good, yeah. but I have to be committed to the idea yeah. of, you That's know.
Interesting.
And
yeah.
But that wouldn't. So, I can't.
It was about negative experiences.
Negative experiences. So I'm quite happy to go back, obviously, as a kind of film historian, if that's yeah. what I am. Or, you know, I'm very happy to go back and spend time thinking about things, but I'm not sure that I do it much within my own personal kind of,
yeah.
like, you know, it's, I don't review myself too often, or if I do, it's in very, very kind of limited ways.
Mm.
And I'm quite happy to I recognise that can be a problem because the trouble is that I will have a tendency to repeat and do things that I should have learned not to do. But that's my big kind of task in later life is to begin to recognise when one repeats or before one repeats, not to repeat.
Well, as long as you're not doing, as I have often done at parties, particularly when I was younger, because the inevitable question would be, so what are you doing? What are you studying? And you'd say, I'm doing a PhD. Or what are you doing it in? Anyway, then you speak to the next person.
Yeah.
And an hour later, you're back to that first person. And you realise that you're giving this stock answer that you've managed after having a few drinks yeah. as well to, you know, and you're getting this really weird look. And they're like, but you told me this an hour ago.
Yeah.
And, and you realise, oh.
No, I've got
we all do it.
Well, I've got friends that tell me, yeah. I mean, probably yeah. I do it to them, yeah. but they tell me the same story yeah. every time. You yeah. know, it's we get a bit yeah. drunk, you know, yeah. and then the same story. Yeah. You know, there's a trigger and a story that is yeah. repeated gets yeah. repeated. Well, and there's real pleasure in hearing it again.
But if it's any consolation, yeah. because I obviously listen back to all these interviews, yeah. and I'm aware, obviously, I put myself into these interviews as well. Yeah. And of course, I'm like, oh, yeah, I wonder if anyone will notice that I've said that in the last three consecutive interviews. But maybe, you know, people don't listen to them in order, so I get away with it.
Yeah, but so in that sense, one can look at it, nostalgia is is about repetition. Yeah. Of course it is. The longing to return is the longing to repeat something. And I am very conscious that I am a repeater. I do things again and again and again.
But often repeating, though, is also a way of correcting, improving, also, and also corroborating to oneself, isn't it? It's almost we're saying, you know, what is my narrative? Yeah. I mean, politicians do that, and often in quite disingenuous ways. But everyone needs to have some sort of sense of, you know, why them? Why should they be entrusted with whatever job that they're after?
Yeah.
And in that sense, they have to have a convincing narrative. And sometimes they do, and sometimes you feel it's a bit put on.
Yeah, I think. I'm aware that one narrativizes, and when you tell a story, you have to be selective on what you choose to focus on.
I've got two more questions. One is, have you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? It sounds like in your case that because you've taken, maybe it's not fair to say a circuitous route, but a route that you, there's no way, I'm guessing, at the age of, I don't know, 15, you would have anticipated that you'd end up where you are now.
No, but I didn't even know this world existed. Yeah. I know my mum and dad were teachers, but I was not interested in them at all, and certainly wouldn't want to have emulated them. I couldn't have imagined it. As a very young lad, I suppose I would want it to be something out in, you know, working in the countryside, you know, a forester or something like that, or a gamekeeper, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that would have been an ideal. And then I asked my dad years after the fact why I ended up working in a factory doing an apprenticeship. We didn't know what you wanted to do. We just had to find you something to do, you know. And I just went along with it. Yeah. You know, I didn't rebel against it. I just thought, well, all right, might as well. I think the moment I kind of got to kind of true kind of adulthood consciousness of what it was to be an individual and to which is to say to be an adult was when I made choices about what I wanted to do, and that was what education, higher education, gave me. It gave me I could see that I had choices, that I didn't just have to. It wasn't just going to be down to chance events, or I wasn't just going to drift, but I could actually determine to some extent the direction that things would take.
Yeah.
And I've had 31 odd years in higher education as a full-time lecturer, and I've achieved everything I wanted to achieve in that. I've had a absolutely fantastic career, a very, very privileged career, because being an academic means that you do have control and determination over how your time, for the most part.
I mean, that word, I think, is autonomy structured. Is an important
one. It is so important. Yeah. I don't think a day has gone by when I haven't thought of that as a truly great privilege.
Yeah.
I can't think of another occupation that has that level of autonomy to determine what you're going to do with your day. I mean, outside of, you know, I have to be at this meeting, I have to, you know, deliver this lecture, or, you know, convene this seminar group. You know, one.
So I guess even if you were a filmmaker, you're still going to be beholden to other people's strictures. You know, you nobody can make a film on their own. Well, you know, they need producers, distributors, directors, actors. You know, so in that sense, you're always going to be at the mercy of.
And maybe that's why it's never appealed. Yeah, it's never appealed to me to make films. I don't. Yeah. It's not a. Being an academic isn't a kind of an alternative to being a filmmaker. It's what it is.
Yeah.
Once I could see that I had choices, it's the only thing I wanted to be. And it's a bit like being a musician, that one can get better at it. One can improve and through practicing constantly and you know, maintaining a kind of engagement with it. One is able to see one's development across time, especially with writing and researching, that, you know, each new project brings with a new set of challenges, but it also carries with a set of old challenges. That's which good. You're still trying. I still want that perfect sentence. What's the perfect opening line for an academic book, you know?
Yeah, but you see, but if you had that, then you'd probably say, well, actually, there's no point. You know, you have to find something else.
I'd feel maybe it was all.
We all strive for perfection, but if we actually reached it, then somehow we'd feel.
But I want to get there. If I got there ever, I'd want to subvert it. I'd feel that I could then, I could then become the great modernist academic, and start subverting it. But there would be something else at the end of it. Yeah. So in many ways, I won't ever stop being a scholar. I'm going to stop being an academic in the sense of teaching and administration, but I won't ever stop writing books or articles, engaging with the topic areas that I've always engaged with.
Absolutely. And then finally, Peter, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Forward, and I think partly that's just because I'm a parent. I've got two wonderful daughters. One's 30, nearly 31, and one's 20. And I think they give that they keep me looking forward because I want to see what happens with them. You know, I want to see how they grow. I want to see how they engage with life. And at the same time, I've got a long list of projects I want to get on and get working with, like the one I mentioned earlier. So I'm not going to. I can't foresee me getting bored.
It's what an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you, Peter. That's been brilliant.
Pleasure to share.